So between the ages of 6 and 7, my family moved from Sierra Leone to Guinea. There had been a coup d'etat in my country, and the war was still going on. So my dad got a job working in Guinea before the Sierra Leonean government. Now, this is significant for one reason. In Sierra Leone, the national language that's taught in school is English. In Guinea, the national language that's taught is French. Now, Sierra Leone, the most common language that's spoken is Creole. That's K-R-I-O, different than Creole. Creole is what you would call Pidgin English. It's mashed English. You might understand certain words if you speak English, but some of it is spoken in a way where you just would not understand it. So we go from that to having to learn French in third, fourth grade. And so we do the orientation for class. Now, back then, my parents were taking care of a cousin of mine who had moved with us to Guinea. And she had taken ill. She got sick the day of the first class, the first day of class. And so I was given the responsibility to let the teacher know that my cousin was sick. And I was told this exact phrase, the first phrase I learned in French. They said, when you get to class, when the teacher asks for your cousin, you say, elle est malade, which means she is sick. She is sick. Now, there's going to be a roll call. I know there's going to be a roll call going to school. So the entire drive over to school, I'm saying this phrase in my head over and over again, which at the time I knew not a single phrase in French because French is spoken in Guinea and I come from Sierra Leone, which English Creole is all I spoke at the time. So I'm learning this and I'm saying to myself, elle est malade, and I'm doing everything to retain it. I walk out of the car, I walk into the courtyard, kids are playing, I get to class, sit at my desk, the teacher gets up front, the national anthem is played, which by this time you're probably thinking, yeah, how is this kid holding on to this, elle est malade? And so I'm holding on to it, and they start calling names, and it's alphabetical, and they get to my last name, Diaby, and I say mine, and then they get to my cousins, and I forget the phrase. You are listening to This Immigrant Life with Jonima Diaby. Let's see, what can I say about my guest today? I met Caroline at an acting conservatory that I was studying at. And the first thing that sticks out about Caroline is her impeccable sense of fashion. This woman just has outfits that she rocks. And she has this bright red hair that just stands out in any room that she's in. Carries herself as if she's maybe a 50s or 60s star. But she's a teacher and one of the most accomplished teachers I have had. An actress as well, but she's taught at NYU, coached so many different actors, and just has a unique way of teaching. And that's the first thing that stood out is I took a class with her, and the exercises she had us do, personally, I hadn't approached acting that way. But we've since become friends. I've worked with her on several different things, and it was a joy to have this conversation with her. So here's my conversation with Caroline.
I was born in France and I grew up in Paris. I was born in Paris.
Okay, whereabouts in Paris? What?
I was born in the 9th arrondissement, and that's below Pigalle. And I was born on a street called Rue des Martyrs. The Martyrdom Street.
Rue des Martyrs.
And you know, because that whole area on top of it is the Sacré-Cœur, you know, and so it means that all the streets are going up and down. And on that street, Rue des Martyrs was called that way because when the Protestants, all their heads were chopped off. by the Catholics during Henry IV. And so the and so when my father and my mother would take me on the street, I could imagine the heads rolling down in the gutter, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's a anyway. Thought. What was Paris like when you were growing up as a kid?
Well, it was much, much after the war. You know, so and this is a street that has a lot of wonderful shopkeepers, food for food. And so I knew, you know, as a little girl, I knew all the people, the butcher, the cheese shop, the veggie shop, the fruit, the bakeries. And so they would always give me little thing. Delicatessens with olives, all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Do you have any siblings when you were growing up, or were you
an only child? No, I did not have. But I think that the most significant thing was that all over Paris, there were sculptures on the street. And my father was a great walker. And he would make me learn every person who had a statue, you know, of course, Joan of Arc, and who was this. And it was like a game, you know. But also, when I took one of my African-American girlfriend to Paris for the first time, and I took her to walk in gardens, well, the gardens are filled with naked women sculptures. And that was such a trip for her. And voluptuous women, you know, with mm-hmm. their breasts and everything. And that makes such a difference when you grow up in a city where there's art. Now New York has started to do that. Even LA, you know, you go on Santa Monica Boulevard and you'll have sculptures. But I was raised with it. Also, people walked. Now in LA, you drive by, so.
What significance did that play in your life as a whole to be able to grow up with such rich art and history of art around you in Paris?
Well, it gave me a sense of beauty, aesthetics, history, because each person that has a sculpture, there's a reason for it. And also the patron of Paris is a woman. It's a saint, Saint Geneviève. So there was, of course, women meant something. Women were very important. And so I never felt this need that I had to compete with men or that I was not an equal to men.
Do you think it's the same way now in France, or do you think that's changed with French culture?
Oh my God. Well, I think it has more to do with the background that you ended up being born in. But right now, there's such an amount of liberation in women speaking up. So there's actually much more women that are adamant in being an equal in every field, being an equal in the same money they are paid. And that is still going on. This is still a struggle. But my field, I did not have to fight that. I did not have to fight for that. Because women, although there's very few plays that in the Shakespeare time, the women roles were played by men, but never in France.
What did your mom do when you were growing up?
She was a singer.
Tell me about that.
My mother came from, her father was a Spanish aristocrat who was, his job was to import rum and cognac. So he would travel from city to city, and he fell in love with a woman in Bordeaux, which is of course the great city for wine. So my mother was the first child, and her mother sent her right away as soon as she was born to a nanny. And my mother did not join the family until she was 3 and a half. And she discovered that she had a little brother. And of course, the little brother became the favorite of the mother. And my mother was very, I don't know if you saw photos of my mother, but she had very black hair.
No.
And she had wavy hair. And so she had olive skin. And because of that, you know, the kids in school were making fun of her. Oh, she's the Spanish, you know, oily hair. So she suffered a lot, my mother suffered a lot. And she idealized, of course, her father, but he would always be on trips. And then when he came home, apparently he was traveling in a carriage, and he would arrive home always singing, and he would eat with white gloves on. So that's, and then one day his wife, my mother's mother, got a message that he had been found dead in a bar, in a sailor's bar in Marseille. And so my grandmother had to come and identify him, and he had apparently had some kind of epileptic crisis, and he was all deformed. And grandmother apparently lost it, you know, when she saw that, because she was so protected, you know. And so at the age of 15, my mother was put in a convent. And so she had her grandmother, and she got out at 18 years old, knowing nothing about life. And I don't know how that happened, but there was a young cello violinist, and she was very beautiful, who courted her. They got married, and he used her family's money for his career. And she discovered that, you know, he was having orgasm, and nothing was happening for her, but she did not know anything. So at that time, at 24 years old, in a provincial town, she decided to divorce, which was amazing. And she went to Paris to take singing lessons, and became a cabaret, singer, because at that time there were a lot of nightclubs place. There was like one or two big venues, but most of the singers, if you wanted to come, you know, the greater singers, Brassens, Serge Gainsbourg, all those people were seen appearing in cabaret. So, so she did a whole turnaround, you know, from her education to come home at 4 o'clock in the morning, drinking and dancing in nightclubs. And it's in a cabaret that she met my father. And my father had been a journalist, a theater critic for a big, big newspaper that still is happening, Le Figaro. And he was having dinner with a bunch of actors from the National Theater. And he saw my mother sing and he got up. He went to her table and he said, he kneeled down and said, "You are the woman of my life. Would you like to marry me?"
Smooth. So you growing up with, because your dad, he was a writer. Did that place, how did you, from growing up and seeing this, how did you get inspired to, one, be an actress, two, for your love of theater? How did that inform that from both sides of your parents?
Well, so my father had been a particular kind of critic. He would take sides. He would publish reviews from other people saying, "No, this actor won't go anywhere." And he would say, this actor is going to be the new star. He was very, really, you know, defending people. And out of that, he was still well known. When I was born, he did not have that job because at the war, the newspaper moved out of Paris and my father did not want to leave his parents behind. So he stayed in Paris and had radio shows describing what was to the soldiers. He would talk to the prisoners and would tell them what was happening in Paris. So anyway, because of that reputation he had, he took me to the theater, I mean, very, very young, at 6, 7 years old. And, you know, we would go always to the premiere because that's where the guest people are. Of course, I wrote a book about this. You know, I feel I'm like telling about my book.
Can you tell me the name of it, please?
It's called En Voyage avec Caroline.
Okay. And is it out?
No, not yet. It's not yet. In the hands of publishers now. It's about my work, you know, my roots, of course.
I see.
So, of course, and what... My connection to become an actress was my parents fought a lot. And they divorced when I was 3. But they had very, very violent scenes. And of course, I discovered that it started with words, that you say something and it hurts somebody or it makes. And so what I discovered when I would go to the theater is that characters could be passionate, express their feelings and not be knifed or punched in the face. So I said, oh, this is where I want to be. So. Yeah. I can express myself safely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the stage became the place where you could be. You could be all the things that you felt inside you.
Mm-hmm.
And life, expressing yourself in life was dangerous.
So what steps did you take towards, because I'm guessing that's the first, was that the first thing you remembered as a kid thinking, that's what I want to grow up to be? Or is there something
yeah.
else?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And what yeah. steps did you take once you made that choice? How did you work towards becoming an actress?
So first of all, in school, you have among the literature class, you have what's called recitations, where you have to stand up and recite a poem or a fable. And of course, my father, who had wanted also to be an actor, you know, would work with me. And I was always like number one, you know, that was the place where I was really shining. And of course, then we had school plays. And so I did that. And, you know, my parents could see that, you know, I had a gift. I had a gift. So as soon as I was, they said, you have to finish your studies, baccalaureate, you know, which is like a, that's the level where you can enter university.
Oui.
So as soon as I was finished at 18 years old, I went to an acting class.
And what was the acting scene like in Paris at the time? What was the teaching? Was it?
We had several kinds of teachers, of course. We had the diction and speech. We had improvisation. I don't remember if we had some kind of movement. And then, of course, the acting, the scene study. And so at the end of the second year, well, there's a showcase, right? And I can't remember if I did 3 years. No, I did 2 years because I won the first prize. You know, they give you a prize, right? So I won the first prize. And then I had a choice. Either I was going to prepare for the National Conservatory Acting School, or it was the year that that wonderful musical, West Side Story. Okay, we had Hair came. You know, the musical Hair.
Yeah.
And West Side Story. And when I saw them, I said, this is it. This is what I want, the way I want to use myself. Because the acting teachers there had been interpreting the same way the same character. You never had to deal with who you are, you know. It's you had to be like this because that's the way this person is, but certainly not give your version. And so, and of course, from a child point of view, I wanted to do this because I wanted to share what I had lived through with all those crazy people around me, you know. And so so at the age of 20, I said, okay, I want to go to New York. And because I had already spent a year in England, so I did not feel like going back to England. And I felt much closer, you know, to this kind of visceral acting, you know, that was American at the time. And so, of course, then I arrived in New York. I knew one person who told me at the beginning because I had met her in Paris. So, you know, some Americans are very friendly. They say, oh, come and you can stay with me. And, you know, and then when I was ready, right, and I called her and I said, okay, I'm coming. And she said, okay, but you can stay 1 week with me.
Yeah, a lot of good that will do.
You know, and so I said nothing to my parents. And at that time, when you were 20 years old, you were not, you had to get a permission from your father. And a paper. And of course, when my parents had divorced, they both had lost my custody because they were declared as crazy. Each one of them was as crazy as the other. So that's why I was put in boarding school almost all my childhood. And my grandparents had my custody, but by then they were dead. So we had to go to the police station to get this paper. We would be lying, right? My father would pretend that he had my custody. And we arrived at this police station, which the head of the that little place, that police station, it was a tiny little staircase, you know. And we arrive, and the guy who is the head there has this kind of red carrot hair. And my father develops a phobia for this man. And he says, the man with the red hair. And it took me 6 months before we managed, because every time we would arrive close to that police station, mm-hmm. my father would visualize the guy and flip out and he would disappear, this man. And so they, you know, they thought we were really crazy. And he would plant me there, you know, he would plant me and disappear on the streets. Like, finally, I got my paper, and on the plane, it was a Sunday, so there was a Sunday Times. And in the art section, they advertise all the acting schools. So I saw HB Studio. So I wrote it down, you know, and I said, okay, that's a place I can go to. And then, you know, nobody picked me up at the airport. I took a cab. I arrived, my friend lived in this very posh, and at the time it was so residential, it was so dead. It's called Sutton Place South. Now it's much more lively. And it was in November. So, you know, it's dark.
Cold.
And there's a doorman. I've never seen a doorman in my life. You know? I arrived with my luggage. And I said the name of my friend, and he says, she's not there.
What?
She's not there. He said, but her mother is there, so you can go up to the mother's apartment. Okay, all right. So he takes me to the floor because the doorman, you know, managed the elevator, and I ring. And I see this little tiny woman called Fräulein, who was a German refugee, right? With this little barking dog. And the mother is not there either. So I arrive in this apartment with nobody except this Fräulein that barely speaks English. And she puts me in this little office place that used to be the office of the father, but the father has deserted the home. But nevertheless, he was a very heavy cigar smoker, and it reeks of cigar. Yeah. And finally, the mother that I had met in Paris, because they had an apartment in Paris and I had met them there. But I have always called her the dryer's broomstick.
Why is that?
Because she was this bony, tall, very angular, you know, no flesh on, and very dry. And then finally, my girlfriend arrives, and she was studying to be a psychoanalyst and a psychotherapist. The mother had not arrived. First, it's my girlfriend, Holly. And she said, okay, well, she was starving. And so this Fräulein had prepared a whole chicken for her. And she ate the whole fucking chicken. Like that, by herself.
Didn't share anything with you, huh?
I have never seen anything like it. But she said, okay, we're going to meet my boyfriend and you can come with us. We're going to go to the YMCA on 96th Street to hear Allen Ginsberg, who was saying his poems. So at least, you know, that was really, really great, you know, to arrive in New York and my first night is to watch Allen Ginsberg. So that was the beginning of my adventures.
How did you come to teach? I know you studied as an actor, but how did you come to teach? Where did that come about?
While I was at HB Studio, it was in 1970s, in the 70s, there was all those avant-garde groups. And HB Studio was in the West Village anyway. And so I saw that this avant-garde group called the Open Theater was doing a production of Endgame in an abandoned building on 14th Street. And it was the kind of last performance, I think. So I went there by myself and it was amazing. I'll never, you know, it was this big building where totally deserted and you had to go on the top floor. And they're doing the last performance of Endgame. And they're using their voices, you know, and their bodies. And I said, this is exactly how I want to use myself. So I waited for them and I shared my enthusiasm and we went out for a drink and I said, well, who did you work with on your voice? Because, you know, Beckett is a classical text, you know. And they said, Kristen Linklater taught at NYU. They gave me her phone number. I left messages after messages and messages. Did not return the call. Finally, I called again and I catch her. And so she hears my French accent and she said, oh, you French, well, come and meet me at NYU and I'll introduce you to everybody. So I go, and she takes me. The head of the theater department was Peter Cass, who's been my mentor. So she introduced me to him, and she says they are having an open workshop, meaning open to other people who are not from the university this summer, if you want to participate. So I said, sure, sure. And so I took the workshop and working with Peter Cass, and the way he made me work, which was, I was doing a Pinter monologue, Harold Pinter monologue. And, you know, I was very respectful of all the pauses and all that. But the monologue, inside the monologue, I was saying, and he, and he, and he, and he, and he. And at the end, he says, well, who is he? And so I start telling him the story. No, not the story in the play. Who is he? Could not. Finally, I understand. Who is that person for me? Who is Caroline talking about? So that was finally how I could bring my human experience to the text. And so I said, this is it. I want to, I have to be part of this program. So I got, you know, I had to audition for the whole faculty, and they took me in. And out of those, when the 3 years were finished, I wanted to go on professionally with those people. Kristen, Peter, and Joe Chaykin, you know, that had been working also at the university, putting on some productions. And Kristen also had the desire to create a company that we were very well funded by all the foundations, you know, so we could be paid. And that was it. My dream happened. But the company was, the goal was to train us as teachers, so that Peter Cass would teach us how to be able to transmit the process, the acting process. Kristen teach us the voice. And we were going to put on shows, of course, plays that was, you know, showing this process. But the difference is we were not rehearsing just to do the play. Like, for instance, Peter would come once a week and we would rehearse all a whole week by ourselves so that we knew exactly what we were doing. And it would come, see where we were at, and he says, okay, now, you know, verbalizes all the pauses. And finally, when we knew exactly what we were doing, then he directed it, you know, in 2 weeks, and we performed. And then we went on tour, and our first workshop of us as teachers was at La Mama the first year. And then we were becoming master teachers and take another 15 people to teach them. And it was a 3-year thing. So that's how I started teaching. And then Peter Cass, who was still the head at NYU, asked me to teach acting at NYU. The first year, which is the most grueling year, because for the whole year, you personalize, you kind of, the goal is that you're going to make each person touch as many aspects of themselves. So it's a constant improvisation, you know, that you break all the taboos. Oh, no, I believe in God, so I cannot say that, you know, all kinds of things. So I taught acting there. And then I had my own private studio, because a lot of people at Juilliard felt they were racist. So I got a lot of Black students at my, you know, and so on. That was the beginning. And out of teaching, of course, I would see so many different versions of the same scene, because the people were different, because that's what we were bringing out, you know, the uniqueness of each actor. Then, you know, it opened me up to direct. So then I started doing the three. I kept acting, teaching, and directing.
A question, it's going to come from left field for you. Where did your sense of fashion come from, Caroline?
I don't think of me as fashion. I think that what's left from my French culture is to be original, to be my own. Of course, I have my own sense of beauty that is mine. It might be completely different for some people, but that's the one I have. And also because my great nourishment is painting. And I was never, you know, I never went to a painting. I never had, you know, when we had art classes, I never had paint or paper because, you know, my father was broke. I mean, it was, so, but we went, my God, to see all the exhibition, the museum. And this is my way of making art.
I got it.
Also, the colors that I wear are emotional, you know, according to how I feel and I wake up, you know, like I feel tired, I'm going to wear orange to pick up my spirit, you know.
Because from the day I met you, the first thing is the red hair stands out, and you have such unique outfits to you that from the very first time I met you, I was like, this woman knows her fashion. She's just always impeccable.
Yeah, well, I don't think of that. And also, you know, I don't know if you know this French writer, poet, and also visual artist called Jean Cocteau.
Have you heard of it? But I will look it up.
Yes, Cocteau also made movies that are very famous. Cocteau.
Nope.
You should see his movies.
Okay.
You should see his movies. It has inspired many filmmakers.
Okay.
But anyway, one of the things he said is to be fashionable is being out of fashion. My second home is really New York.
Okay. And why?
I mean, I became who I was in New York. I became who I am in New York. And also I was very lucky to arrive in the 70s. There was such a sense of freedom there. You could talk aloud on the street, yell, whatever. You nobody paid attention. You were completely free.
I love that.
And I was alone. I was far away from my culture. I was, you know, It's a fantastic city to find yourself. I don't know if it's still the same because it is so expensive now. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely is.
Yeah.
What's something about France that you think every American could benefit about experiencing? What's something so unique to France that, because I know you go there every year, right?
Well, that's what I told you earlier. Walk in the gardens and look at art in the street. Bathe your eyes with art. And the beauty of the city, walking at different hours of the day. I mean, I was, you know, when I was from 16, even sometimes 14, you know, walking at 4 o'clock in the morning and seeing dawn. And, you know, oh my God, those beautiful skies and crossing the river. I mean, you know, so. I never felt alone in Paris, you know, never felt alone.
One last question. If you could have dinner with any two people in life, dead or alive, anyone, who would they be, Caroline?
There are so many I would have liked to have dinner with. I mean, you know, like a man like Fellini. Federico Fellini.
Mm-hmm.
I would have also liked to have dinner with François Truffaut. I would like to have dinner with Obama. I mean, you know, I would, you know, have liked to have a dinner with Cecily Tyson. You know, so many people, so many people.
You know, I just saw Sounder for the first time, and what a movie. Cicely Tyson, Sounder.
We watched the other night the autobiography of Mr. Something.
I haven't seen it yet.
She plays a woman who's 102. The charm that this woman, the grace that she has. I'm very, very sensitive to that.
Who was your best friend growing up, Caroline?
Oh, it's marvelous. My best friend. Well, my best friend was my first love. So we had, when we were in boarding school from the age of 14 to 17, and we drove each other so crazy that she was kicked out of school and I had to double my year. So that's when I decided to go to England to do the same year, but by correspondence, and at the same time, be fluent in English. And afterwards, when I came back to Paris, I really didn't want to see her. Maybe she had a baby. I remember I went to see her in that apartment with that little baby. And then, you know, we were scared of each other because, you know, we had an intense love relationship. You know, at that age where you have to prove, no, you love me, I love you more, you know. And I did two suicide attempts. I threw myself out of a mountain and I was very lucky. And because I landed on a bed of rocks, but there was water. Because I thought that I had broken every bones in me. And then another time, because that boarding school was outside Paris, so every Saturday night we took the train. And again, we have a scene, you know. And so I opened opened the doors of, and I, you know, tried to throw myself out of the train. And so we disappeared out of each other's life. And maybe now 10 years ago, no, she sent, when, She knew I was friend with this woman writer who lives in my building in Paris. And so she sent a postcard to my friend and said, look, can you pass on this postcard to Caroline? She gives her phone number. So I called her and I really, we could have turned into the worst people, you know, from where we came from. She could have become a whore or have crazy, whatever. And she tells me that she had an art gallery and she's completely into art. And I said, oh my God, this is really wonderful. And I had always my birthday in Paris. So I invited her to my birthday. She didn't come. Okay, I forget about her. Years pass. And because she had told me that she had this art gallery and she took care of artists, there was an exhibition of Californian artists at the Pompidou. And so I was visiting my mother in her apartment and going to that show. And in the bus, I thought of her. I thought of her. And I said, maybe I'm going to see her, right? And sure enough, I'm in the show with my friends. Somebody tapped my shoulders. And she asked, are you Caroline Ducrot? And there she is with her daughter. And I say, okay, you know, that's a sign that now we are ready to have. And to this day, she's my best girlfriend.
Oh, wow. You still keep in touch.
Oh, my God. I mean, we talk to each other twice a week.
That's amazing.
Yes, and oh yeah, no, amazing, beautiful. You know, my friend Casey Lemon said, you have to write that story as a screenplay, but I don't know how to start anyway.
Well, you start when you guys were kids, and what made you fall in love, right?
Yeah.
Carole, merci bien. Thank you. You didn't have to do this, and you were super generous with your time. And
of course,
I love you for it, and I love you regardless. But
let me know when you are ready that I can ask you questions.
Absolutely.
And that was my conversation with my good friend, one of my favorite people in the world. A mentor, Caroline, so honest, so genuine, and has lived an amazing life. Caroline is a director, writer, teacher in Los Angeles. I will post young photos of Caroline and a photo of her mom in reference to the episode. But until next time, please keep listening. Subscribe. Give us a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast. We're on all of them. And check us out on Instagram at This Immigrant Life Podcast. And that's it. So until next time, until the next guest, au revoir.